Thank you very much for that introduction. It really is a pleasure to be here this morning and at this conference. These slides reflect a pub that's actually in Oxford. I don't think I've ever shown it in Oxford before, but the main point here is to realize the river isn't usually at this level and being pumped back out the windows of the pub. This slide and the next one are to give you an idea of the kind of space and time scales that decision makers, well, what counts as small? First, that the decision makers want decisions on. So the question, there are a number of different complications that come in as well. One of the reasons this flood was so painful was that smoking had just been banned in England and the pub had been completely redecorated along with a large number of other pubs. So there are many things other than just the weather that impact these decisions. And as we keep going forward in time, this is from February, we see that actually the pub is now to let. So the real questions I want to address are whether or not climate science can tell this publican, John, what a 4-degree world would be like in his pub. Or what are the space and time scales where we can actually communicate information about a different world? It doesn't necessarily need to be one location, but it needs to be, well, the question is what resolution can we give for an insurer or a reinsurer who's caring about many different locations? Okay. And in fact, now it's no longer John, it's now Michel. Who's running the George. Michelle is from Liverpool. But this is a question. Can we get countrywide information? Can we get local information? How does that kind of information sit? This is a second way in which I'm going to talk about small scales. These are the Sandwich Islands. This is a satellite photograph. This is what happens when you put an island in a flow around the atmosphere, right? There's lots of local scale development. So how many of these kind of physical details can we actually miss out and still yield quantitative decision-relevant support downstream? That's downstream both in time and in space. So clearly we may not need these islands, but would it be bad if we missed a kilometer-long wall that ran the length of South America? Right? What are the space and time scales where not having those things in our models have real impacts? So here's my title. The original idea, 1, 2, 3 more, was to think, as we go forward and temperatures change from the baseline in which we've observed our models, we expect parameterizations to start to fail. We expect the models to be less and less realistic relative to what the world would do at those temperatures. So where do we actually sort of lose that kind of information? In fact, in looking at some of the models, I now actually think there's some challenges in using models for a 0-degree warmer world. And I just want to try to discuss what some of those challenges are and what the variability we see in those models are today. So there are many different 4-degree worlds. Okay. Many, many different 4-degree worlds. So inside the models, we can also ask this question, how different do those worlds look? Today's models don't appear likely to provide quantitative decision support, quantitative probabilities about the details that we need for things like a pub. But where do they supply good information? Is it at continental scales? Is it somewhere below? Right. It's very clear, right? There's nothing naysayer skeptical about this talk. It's very clear that exploring a four-degree world empirically would have a huge ecological, human, and economic costs, large negative impacts. The question is, how do we communicate clearly what we actually know? How do we maintain the credibility of science and climate science in terms of policy support when we have limited information about what that will be like? And I'd suggest that if we lower the bar, we can make applied science much more useful, much less volatile, and much, much easier to advance. Okay? So first of all, how would we actually test whether or not we had decision support relevant information? Well, here's a question for your publican. Or your water catchment area, or some national, I'd like to think of bigger questions. It's hard to think of really big questions at work. But the first issue is, can we actually look at the question in terms of local environmental phenomena that impact it? What are the phenomena that make a difference to this publican, or to someone selling soft drinks, or to someone interested in cooling a power station? So things like long, hot, dry periods, extended periods with no rain and excessive temperatures. Then we can ask for this location. What are the larger scale meteorological phenomena that impact those local phenomena? For the UK, that could be things like blocking. Right. Then we can identify the relevant drivers that we know about. What causes, using the science, not the models, what causes blocking? So there could be orographic effects. Then we can back up and we can look for necessary, right? Never sufficient, but purely necessary conditions for model output to quantitatively inform just thinking about it, just taking the science. The wildfire talk we had yesterday was an excellent one. We can think about what will happen in wildfire ecologies, including Florida, and think of how this will likely change given likely changes in the environment. Right? When do our models actually add value to that kind of scientific reflection? Are the local phenomena today realistically simulated in the model? Can we actually get it for the current climate? Right? We're talking about a lot of nonlinear interactions here locally. Right, so I'll come back and touch on anomalies in just a minute. If they're not relevant, can we do something similar to perfect Prague? Can we actually find ways of walking between model space and reality statistically that we think will be robust as climate change? And are all the drivers represented? Right, we've heard a lot about the laws of physics and we're effectively extrapolating based on our belief in the laws of physics. But the laws of physics only work if they're all in there, right? If the relevant bits are all in there. So are they or not? Are these conditions really likely to hold as we follow through this trajectory of our model? Right. So in fact, now we look at the trajectory. Some trajectories we may have small warming. We may think the model holds very well. Other trajectories, the model trajectory may go outside the range where we think the simulation is realistic. What do we do in that case? If we really can't clear those hurdles, the scientific value of these results doesn't make them valuable for decision makers. And in fact, talking about them, presenting them, can actually be a detriment. And any claim that their best available information is false and misleading. The science at some of these questions will provide more useful information than model output. So our model samples some ill-defined mathematical space, a fairly bland world. They're sort of like the Earth, but they're systematically less rich. So there's a real question of what distributions from those models can do and how we can actually use the science to suggest the space and time scales, right, which we expect to sort of get longer as we go further out into the future, where we can get decision-relevant information. The second question, then, is how do we communicate that insight to decision makers? I've asked a question a couple of times about what's the probability of a big surprise. Just can we attach to each method, each study that we do, an idea of how likely we think those results are to be relevant? And I'll go back and give an idea of that, too. That actually allows us to explore methodologies, which are useful methodologies, but may not be insightful applied to today's models. So first of all, I'm going to step on and look at uncertainty in the AR4 models. Now, this gray band represents traditional uncertainty, right? These colored bands are a little different. This is model diversity, right? And we don't yet have evidence that we even get things like the law of large numbers, right? We keep adding more models, the standard deviation keeps getting bigger. So that's a very different thing than uncertainty in observations. And these bars over here on the right, well, this is a subjective probability of the likely range of what's going to come out in 2100. So it's important to disentangle this kind of information, especially when you're giving summaries to policymakers, and not confuse this kind of sampling uncertainty where we really think we know what's happening, there's something in there, from this sort of diversity. We have a bunch of different models, and they do these different things. If we were to see a trajectory like this, would it count as a big surprise? Well, no, because, in fact, for the red line, right, this is within the likely range. If we were to see a trajectory like this, would it count as a big surprise? Well, yes, but in fact, this has the Earth warming up so fast that we don't need a model to suggest that it's not going to be physical. So it's this interplay between where the models really add value, and that's very different in mitigation questions than it is in adaptation questions. Where can we actually get information? So a good way to do is to go back and look at the previous century and ask where we can get it there, and even ask, where do the models agree with each other? Now, this is taking one step deeper, going to about page 600 in the IPCC, and we see that we have the individual models here instead of just a band. But what's important to remember is this is not temperature. This is temperature. Right? So what you see here is about a 3-degree range between the model global mean temperatures. What you see here is what happens if you subtract off the systematic error between 1900 and 1950. So this difference, the line that doesn't change much is the observations, right? For mitigation, you can make arguments that since they agree in sensitivity, they will give similar information and urge similar caution. For adaptation, differences in global mean temperature of this size, right, are huge. And what does this kind of differences, this kind of diversity in our models imply for actual local questions? Well, here's the vision of a 0-degree world, This is just the range of uncertainties, taking the warmest global mean temperature AR4 model and the coolest and subtracting them point-wise. You can look at lots of other graphs, but the point to say here is that even for a 0 degree warmer world, we have huge local differences in what we think, what the models suggest happened between 1900 and 1950 on average. It's a 50-year average. Okay. So those impacts, that fact makes it very difficult to work out how to interpret models and how models will evolve in the future, right? How to use those for adaptation, to make decisions. Anomalies could be fine if we're interested in global changes, but they don't make sense for claims involving the laws of physics. In our models, it's not internally consistent. Ice will melt around 0 degrees. Crops, plants will die, right? Forests will change at certain real temperatures. The fact that we have this huge diversity among our models and include that level of complexity in them makes it very, very hard to pull these sorts of things out. Okay. So how do we communicate the information that is in there without looking at things that aren't in there? Well, we can look for things the model can't do. This is just one example. There's several. If you actually go back and use the sea surface temperatures of the 1930s and ask whether or not the GIS model in ensemble mode can reproduce the Dust Bowl drought, a huge economic driver, the answer is, well, yes, but it's off by hundreds, if not 1,000 kilometers, and it's sort of in the wrong place in the wrong depth. That's knowing the sea surface temperatures. So the sorts of places we should expect big surprises is when the models that we're using to try and get these distributions out, well, anything as small as the Dust Bowl, right? A decade-long major drought. These are the sorts of things that we don't have realistic representations of even in the past. So why is this so hard? Well, for this publican, right, it's hard because the things he actually needs are very high resolution. They're high resolution sort of locally in space and time. The decisions that we have to face, that they're trying to answer, don't depend on average meteorological variables or the standard deviation of average weather, but actually on the trajectory. They depend on climate the way it was defined by the American Meteorological Society in 1958. Okay? We have to follow this little trajectory around, right, and ideally find when it crosses thresholds. Those are the thresholds that are important to this publican or someone else. We can back up and see what thresholds we can realistically cross and what we can't. But we need to communicate whether or not we believe for a particular application whether or not these results are going to be robust. Okay. So here's another example. Let's suppose we believe the models are useful, are realistic. We want to see the variability of looking at global mean temperature. Then we have this issue. This is looking at Central North America, a large region. This is a distribution corresponding to a 3-degree world. And this is a distribution of temperatures, right? December, January, February temperatures, corresponding to a 5-degree world. The point is, from an adaptation point of view, if you're looking to use the models, you're going to have a lot to adapt to. The difference between 3 and 5 is large, but there's a huge amount of overlap. The information desired is for much higher resolution information. Can we provide that? And if we can't, then can we make sure that we make it clear the limits of what we're actually providing? So let me just give you a few more examples of what the drivers are, and then I'll stop. This is one of these issues. This is the sort of the resolution of HAD-CM3. This is what's broadcast on the BBC a few years ago, showing lots of details about a typical summer's day in 2080. Right? A CEO of a major company seeing this thinks he can mitigate really rather, since he can adapt really rather well. Right? But that kind of information generally isn't available. Similarly, we have a project with Norway where they're interested in the difference between precipitation in the eastern and western parts of Norway. But Norway is mostly one grid box. So how can we actually get information from that? Can we do something like one-way regional modeling? Well, the difficulty of doing one-way regional modeling is we can put a mountain in Norway, but where does the actual water go? Well, the water falls out over Norway in the regional model, but in the global model, it keeps on going. And it falls out somewhere else in some other regional model. It may go around the world and fall out in Norway again and again and again. This kind of one-way coupled models don't catch the dynamics that are really relevant, right? And if we're going to use phrases like based on the laws of physics, we need to actually check for internal consistency quantitatively. This isn't a question of how to downscale. This is a question of whether or not to downscale. So is this a big problem or not? Well, here are the errors in HAD-CM3. Height, right? The observed height minus had to see him three height. The red is where the difference is more than a kilometer. So you can see there are places in their ridges in Norway where we have 500 meters, and the Andes provide more or less this 1 kilometer wall. Can we physically interpret things downstream of this as reasonable? And what's the time scale, the lead time scale, on which failing to resolve the impact this has on the flow, right? The Sandwich Islands are down here somewhere, right? What's the time scale on which failing to resolve the flow here will have a large impact on things downstream? Thank you very much. So here's another, this is a nicer picture that Anna has made for us, right? I just want to say that again, right? This is a higher resolution set of the observations. These are you can see the HADCM3 grid squares. You can see the size of these sorts of altitude errors. This isn't a subtle process, right? We know that when air hits a mountain, it has to go over it or around it. It doesn't go through it, except in the model. We've seen what happened to weather forecasts when we began to resolve the Alps. It completely changed precipitation patterns in northern Italy. Maybe they weren't at the right time, but at least the patterns were roughly correct. We don't have that kind of information now. And that kind of dynamical, simple dynamics will have a large impact on what we'll see in the future. We just need to quantify when, and we need to make sure we explain that to decision makers so that as science advances and we begin to resolve some of these processes and systems, we can get them to embrace the improvement in the models. So let me give you very quickly one other example. This sort of problem, although it's interesting that climate science is sort of different. This exists in all decision support questions. This is a foe, a potentially hazardous object by NASA, right? And we can ask exactly the same question if we have models like Newton's laws, and we want to see what's the chance of a particular asteroid that we've just discovered hitting the Earth in the next 10,000 years, right? Is the probability of a big surprise of our model leading us badly wrong, is that high or low? Okay. So what we can do, we can take Newton's laws. Here's our asteroid. We just start doing a Monte Carlo study with some prior distribution. As long as all the trajectories stay out here, then the distributions we get from our Monte Carlo run is very likely to be informative about the likelihood of this asteroid hitting the Earth. But if we see trajectories which actually come close to the Sun, we know that Newton's laws don't work for Mercury or objects close to the Sun. Here we actually need general relativity. We know that things like discrepancy, ways trying to get statistical fixes by looking at many different models of Newton's laws, are systematically wrong near the Sun. It's not a question of our approximating the equations. It's not uncertainty. It's inadequacy. It's not that the model is uncertain. It's that the model is incapable of getting the relevant phenomenon in this case. So what do we do if we lose 12% of our simulations this way? If we know that a certain fraction of our simulations aren't able to go into places where we know the model is not informative. It's very easy to know that the model class is inadequate without knowing how to improve it. So what's the value of ensemble simulations in this case? And how do we communicate that issue? How do we communicate the fact that we know either that some of the simulations are likely to be misleading or that the models themselves are unable to represent certain processes that we think might be important? So My suggestion, and I'm very open to others, my key is just to find a way to communicate this, is to go for this question of a big surprise. Big surprises happen when something our models can't mimic turns out to have important implications from us. Climate science can sometimes warn us of where those who use naive, if complicated, model-based probabilities will suffer from a big surprise. If we know that there's a phenomenon that leads to long warm periods in the UK, and we know that our models don't get those well, then if you're talking to someone who's interested in cooling towers or soft drink sales, right, there are ways to tell them that these aspects are likely to be missing from our model. We need to communicate that whenever we try to communicate quantitative information. Big surprises invalidate the foundations of model-based probability forecasts. There are many statistical ways of adjusting to new information. Here we're changing the output space. We don't really know, theoretically, how to move forward in that case. And failing to highlight this kind of problem can lead to a loss of credibility for climate science and for science-based policy as a whole. And this has actually been observed in other places like earthquake forecasting, where claims were overstated, And the result was a real decrease in the use of the useful information 2 decades ago. So including information about the probability of a big surprise in each individual case study allows the use of probabilities conditioned on the model being fit for purpose without actually us having to believe that it is, or us appearing to suggest to other people that they should act as if it was. We can actually show, by seeing this probability go down, if we get more and more confidence that our models are relevant. And so we can ask questions. As we move forward, right, as models improve, we have ideas of what temporal detail we can look at, what spatial detail we can resolve, and what lead times, as other processes kick in, we can actually look for. What are the contours of the probability of a big surprise look at as we move out further and further? Where does a 4-degree world, the nearest 4-degree world, lie in terms of current climate modeling in this case? So this is Sherlock Holmes. When you've eliminated all which is possible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. This is core value of probability theory. Even Spock says it. Whenever you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be true. Of course, it's also something you might have left out. And that's the point. Right? What's the chance? We can have subjective beliefs. We can actually have good scientific basis for believing there's the probability that we miss something relevant. We might even know what it is. These don't need to be unknown unknowns. Like the Andes, these can be known unknowns or known unconsiders. How do we actually communicate that information? Thank you very much.